Hello, Misfits. This is Kate.
And this is Kevin.
Welcome to Horrorwood.
Hi.
I don't know what I was going to say there. Other than, you know, it's been a week and we were just here like a couple days ago. This is technically coming out within the same week, I think.
That's right.
Yeah.
Weeks meld together anymore. I don't know.
Weeks, months, years. It's all one continuous stream.
One continuous stream of horror.
Kind of.
Yeah. What's that quote? There's a quote from like Absolutely Fabulous where Jennifer Saunders' character says, I hit a oil patch at like 30 and now I'm just sliding to the grave.
I've never heard that. I loved that show in college though.
Oh my God. I had the book of DVDs, like yeah. The collection DVDs. And you know how she had that like really bright, glittery
silver
puffer jacket? That's what the box was made of.
Fun.
It was really cool.
My favorite was Bubble. I love Jane Horrocks.
Bubble.
We're here for part two of our Gig Young episodes. Mm-hmm. The finale. This is not a three-parter. I did get it done in two.
I was half expecting you to be like, guess what?
I saw the look on your face. The terror. The anticipation.
It wouldn't have been terror, honestly. Like, I like your deep dives. I was just like, where else are we going?
This one, it is going to be kind of a long episode, but you'll get everything today. So, with that said, I do want to clarify one thing in part one that drove me crazy. So I kept saying after he married Sheila, his first wife, I kept saying it was Sophie who didn't like to go out to the parties. It was Sheila who didn't like to go out to the parties.
Oh.
And I know that was kind of confusing, but maybe some people didn't even care or didn't even notice. It drove me nuts, though, because afterwards I was like, I edited the whole thing and then I was like, wait a second.
Oh, no.
It was Sheila.
Okay. Sheila Stapler.
Sheila Stapler, yep.
Was his first wife.
Yes.
And then Sophie
was the second.
Now it all comes flooding back into my memory.
Yes. I do also want to say at the top of this, there is mention of sexual assault, suicide, and domestic abuse in this episode. So please listen with caution. We left off in part one with Gig's marriage to Elizabeth Montgomery ending in divorce. They'd gotten into that huge fight where both of them left the house and left their dog, Mr. Boo, alone.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah, so he was alone for more than 24 hours. He destroyed the place.
He tore the place up. He tore it up.
Tore it up. And I don't know where I'm going.
I love that.
And we had a listener on Spotify comment, and she wanted to know if the dog had a happy ending. So Bella, to answer your question, yes, Mr. Boo was okay. I don't know which one of them ended up with him. I think it was Elizabeth Montgomery, but I'm not positive. But just thought I would let you know.
The dogadoos are okay.
Well, I mean,
the other one got hit by a car, right?
So, yeah.
Oh, God.
It's been a rough dog day here because
Frankie's
had a bad day. And we took her to the vet and they were like, nothing's wrong, but something's definitely wrong. And so it's just been one of those like kind of touch and go kind of days. And we're a little nervous, but we're working through it. I'm working through it.
Sorry. Oh, did you hear what my voice just did?
No. I didn't even hear that.
Like my fucking bullfrog.
I liked it. So at the end of part one, we left off. Gig is now 50 years old. He's alone and he turned to more alcohol. He turned to younger girls and psychedelic drugs as a means to try and feel youthful. And he began dating Elaine Whitman, who he'd been seen with while married to Elizabeth. So we mentioned her briefly in part one, and now those two are together. After a few months of dating, Elaine got pregnant, and Gig was thrilled to learn that he was actually capable of fathering a child. Because remember, he'd had the vasectomy, then he had it reversed, but yes. Him and Elizabeth were never able to conceive.
That's right.
So Gig decided he should marry Elaine. He believed this time it's going to last. Spoiler alert, it doesn't last.
I figured.
Friends thought the two were all wrong for each other. Their age gap was even bigger than the one between him and Elizabeth. So Elaine was 22 youngers. Uh-oh, it's evening. It's an evening recording and I don't do well with those. Okay, Elaine was 22 years younger than Gig, and people were worried Gig was rushing into another marriage too fast because, I mean, it was pretty soon after Elizabeth. But nevertheless, they got hitched, and their daughter Jennifer was born in April of 1964. Pretty soon after they married, Gig became very controlling.
Ew.
He told Elaine that the only way they could have a happy, successful marriage was if she gave up her career. And here's the thing. Elaine was a really successful realtor, but he wanted her to focus on being a housewife and a mom. Ew.
Boo.
He also, this is real fucked up, he also made her take cooking classes because he said that would turn her, quote, from a sandwich girl into a gourmet cook. So he wants someone who's just gonna be there to cook for him, clean for him, take care of Jennifer. That's his thing. He's like, and he thinks that's the key to a happy life.
I want a pair of crushed velvet sweatpants that say sandwich girl on the butt.
Merch. We'll get on it.
Yeah.
At first, Elaine went along. Okay.
You got this, Kate. I believe in you.
Thank you.
I believe the children.
I just gotta believe in myself. At first, Elaine went along with his demands because, truthfully, she liked the celebrity lifestyle. Huge stars like Bette Davis would show up at their home, and she loved it. She loved playing hostess to all of them.
Didn't he sleep with Bette Davis?
Sure did, but they stayed friends throughout his life.
Oh, hey, okay.
But Elaine didn't love his drinking. It was getting way out of hand.
Yika.
So she encouraged him to go to AA. And he did quit for a while. He also booked a TV series, so financially, things were looking really good for him. He bought a Rolls Royce, he bought a mansion, and he bought a couple of toupees because his hairline was receding and he was self-conscious.
Toupees, man. Do you know anybody who's worn toupees?
Probably.
Oh. No. I mean, my dad bought a toupee once, and I just remember him putting it on, and my mom just, like, burst out laughing.
Aww.
It was really sad.
Aww. I'm sure I have known people that have worn them. Nothing wrong with it. Like, do it makes you feel good.
Yes. Yes.
I can sense that Kevin has some differing feelings about toupees.
I don't know. Honestly,
toupees.
It doesn't bother me. If you do what you want with your body.
Yeah.
Do what you want. What you want with your body.
Okay. This is a total side note.
Yeah.
But when I was in sixth grade, we had to watch a video about, like, Stranger Danger.
Ah.
But there was a song that went along with it.
What?
And I remember it. And it goes like this.
I'm so excited.
My body's nobody's body but mine. You touch your own body. Let me touch mine. And that just made me think of that.
I love that. And I think
Who
that
wouldn't?
We should have more songs about like how to express ourselves. I was at the doctor's office once. Sorry, I'm going to tell a little anecdote now. But there's a show called Daniel Tiger.
Of course.
Like, do you know Daniel
Everyone
Tiger?
Everyone knows Daniel Tiger.
I fucking love Daniel Tiger. I think adults should watch this shit because they could learn a few things.
Oh.
But there was a song that he was singing, and it was, use your words and say how you feel. That's all I remember.
Oh, okay. I was like ready to go.
I just bring back jingles.
I just really appreciate that sixth grade song that I learned.
I think that
it stayed with me.
That would be a really good soundtrack to our true crime podcast.
Yes, it would, actually. Unfortunately, though, the TV series that he had booked was canceled after just one season, and he and Elaine were forced to give up the mansion.
Boo.
Gig became withdrawn and very secretive, and he started drinking again, which, of course, led to a lot of fights between him and Elaine. Because of their age difference, Gig didn't feel like he could keep up with her and her friends. And he also felt insecure sexually. And because of this, he jumped to the conclusion that, oh, she must be talking shit about me to her friends and she's probably cheating on me.
Oh, insecurity will do that to you.
Very insecure man. So listen what he does, though. He has the house bugged. He began recording all her phone conversations, all her visits with her friends, and then he would collect these tapes and go out on his boat and listen to them for hours, just waiting to find something incriminating.
Did he?
Well, here's what he did, because he would pick like one little thing and harp on that. So, like, he took the tapes to an editor and had him edit them in a way that would seem like she was up to something. What is so funny?
It's just like, sorry, this is really immature of me, but it's just like every now and then you hear, like, her rip a fart, and he just, like, edits all those. And it's like, you're disgusting. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry.
You do not need to apologize. And you know what? I'd like to think that that is what he did.
He takes a sip of scotch. Yeah, I got the giggluns.
You got the gig youngs. The gig youngs. Is that what you said? That wasn't even that funny.
Oh, that was really funny. I got the gig youngs.
Well, no one's listening to us anymore, so we can just talk about whatever
just,
we
let's
want.
Let's do what we want.
All right.
Okay.
He took the tapes.
Yes.
To an editor. And had him edit them in a way that would seem like Elaine was up to something, even though she wasn't. For instance, Elaine told a friend over the phone that she'd seen Robert Wagner at a party. Robert Wagner, the actor. And she said, oh my God, Bob Wagner is so wonderful. I just love him. But my husband is so much more gorgeous.
Ooh.
Those were her exact words.
Wow.
Gig had the part she said about him being more gorgeous edited out. He would then take the tapes to her and be like, oh, so you have a thing for Bob Wagner? So it was shit like that.
Oh, I don't love that.
Just imagine if your partner is secretly recording you. Like,
no, that's not cool.
Yeah, that would be the end for me, I think. Gig insisted they both seek psychiatric counseling. Friends recommended Dr. Albert Duvall, whose techniques were unorthodox, to say the least.
Fucking shit. Some Hollywood therapist who's like, oh,
like, just
like
that. Woof,
like, you know, woo-woo, if they
will. It was a little bit more criminal than that.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's not what I was expecting.
No. Okay. I don't think Elaine was expecting it either. So what Dr. Duvall would do is force his patients to get naked before asking them personal questions. Gig was all for it, but Elaine was like, yeah, that's not really my vibe. And she definitely was against the therapy sessions after Dr. Duvall sexually harassed and abused her during her visits because she wouldn't take off her clothes.
Oh.
Yeah. So she stopped going to therapy, no surprise there, and Duvall referred Gig to a psychologist in Canada who practiced LSD therapy.
Ooh.
Cary Grant had also undergone LSD therapy and raved about it, so Gig was like, sign me up. And I think we should do a whole episode on LSD therapy in Hollywood, and I think you should cover it.
Can I do that?
Yeah, I just said I think you should cover it.
I want that. I want that for myself.
This is what
us.
I'm saying to you. Take
Thanks,
it.
Kate. No. It's just, that's a fascinating, I've talked about this with you a lot.
Yeah.
Like, it's a fascinating topic to me.
And it wasn't until I was researching this that I realized Hollywood even had like this whole spell of LSD
yeah,
therapy.
I didn't know Hollywood had it. I knew it was a thing that was being studied, mm-hmm. but I didn't realize that it became like a fad in Hollywood.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
Ooh.
Gig loved the LSD mm-hmm. treatment. He thought it had really helped him, and when his treatment was over, he felt ready to make a fresh start with Elaine.
Okay.
But it didn't take long at all before the two were right back to fighting.
Yucca.
Then one day, Gig and a friend went out on his boat sailing and drinking all day, and they came back to Gig's house completely drunk. They were loud. Elaine was pissed because she was worried that they were going to wake up Jennifer, who's still a baby, and she
baby Jennifer.
Is that a thing?
No, I just like that.
Oh. I thought it was like baby Jessica who
fell
on the well.
Who fell on the well. Yeah.
So Elaine was worried that he was going to wake up baby Jennifer, and she couldn't believe he had gotten as drunk as he had. So that pissed Gig off, and he slapped her.
No.
She kicked both men out of the house, and that was the end of marriage number 4 for Gig.
Damn, dude.
After that, he started dating an even younger woman.
No.
She was 22, and he was around 55 at the time. Her name was Sky Aubrey, and she too felt Gig's drinking was out of control. One night, they were out at Joe Allen's, which is a famous restaurant in New York. They were having dinner with friends, and Sky noticed Gig was drinking pretty heavily, but he seemed fine to her, like he was handling it well. At one point, he excused himself to go use the restroom, and she's like, okay, yeah, sure. A few minutes go by, he hasn't come back yet. A few more minutes go by, he hasn't come back. And finally, she starts getting worried. Like, she's like, did he get sick? Did he maybe pass out? What's happening?
As my mom would have said, did he fall in?
Maybe he did. Maybe he did. So Sky gets up and asks one of the employees, hey, can you go check on my man? Like, I'm not sure if he's doing all right. So the employee says, sure, goes to the men's restroom, and no one's there.
Ooh.
And Sky was like, what are you talking about? Like, he went in there a few minutes ago. So she called Gig's place, and after it rang several times, he finally answers, and she's like, what are you doing home? And Gig said, where are you? Aren't you here? I thought you were in the bathroom.
What?
He totally forgot about her at the restaurant.
And just left?
He hailed a cab, he went home, got into the hot tub, thinking she was in the apartment.
Oh, he was confused and probably blacked out.
But despite this type of behavior, she really loved him and wanted to marry him. However, he refused, probably for the best, and eventually things between the two fizzled out, though they did still stay friends. His career was also fizzling, and his agent, Marty Baum, resigned from the agency and took a job as the vice president of the American Broadcasting Company's film division. He'd always been Gig's cheerleader, so Gig was feeling at a loss because this was his agent who now he's gone. And his decades of drinking weren't doing him any favors. His looks were definitely starting to fade. And he had added sedatives to his list of preferred substances.
Oh, well, that's not great.
Not a good combo. But there was a ray of hope. It turns out Marty's move from agent to ABC would prove to be incredibly beneficial to Gig.
Yeah.
Marty's first project was the film They Shoot Horses, Don't They?
I've heard of that.
Stars Jane Fonda. It's a film about contestants in a dance marathon, and he insisted that Gig play the role of the alcoholic MC. Unfortunately, that's the type of role he started getting in his later years.
No.
Yeah,
and he was never the leading man, and never so he man. Just started getting cast as the alcoholic, which is what he was.
Yes.
That's actually kind of sad.
It is a very sad story. Like, and the whole ending is sad. It's just sad, y'all. And if you remember from part one, Gig used to go watch the dance contest with Mrs. Keynes. Yes. So he actually did take inspiration from that for the role. Before the film was even released, people were taking notice of Gig's performance. Buzz was already forming about an Oscar nomination, and they weren't even done shooting yet. That's how good he was.
Oh.
Gig urged his longtime press agent, Jay Bernstein, who was also a good friend, to start building an Oscar campaign for his performance. Mm-hmm. But Bernstein said, no, I've done that with other actors. It ended horribly. Until I see the finished movie, I'm not going to start any buzz.
Fair.
Yeah. Gig kept urging him, though. He's like, you got to start a campaign. You got to start like drumming up some publicity. He was like, come on, man, this is the one. I know I'm really good in it. But Bernstein wouldn't do it. When the two men finally sat and watched the finished film together, Bernstein told Gig, you were right. You were incredible. Not only do I think you'll get nominated, I think you're going to win. And Gig was like, I have waited 6 months for you to say that. Thank you. And now that you have said it, you're fired. Bernstein was like, what? And Gig said, you didn't believe me when I told you I was doing a good job, and that hurt. So you're fired. And just like that, he ended a long-term business partnership and friendship. Gig was nominated for Best Supporting Actor, along with 4 other men, including Elliot Gould for Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, and Jack Nicholson for Easy Rider. And the Oscar went to...
Jack Nicholson.
Gig Young.
Oh. Sorry.
Finally.
Kate was like, say it. I was like, the wrong answer.
But you would kind of expect, you like, you hear Jack Nicholson's name.
I mean, he's having such a shit time in his life. I was like, well.
Gig finally won the Oscar. And you can watch the clip of him online accepting his award. He's practically running up to the stage. He looks so giddy. He looks like a little boy in an old man's body, if that makes sense.
Yes, that does.
Professionally, he was back on track. But personally, he was dealing with a bunch of legal issues regarding his ex-wife, Elaine. They had a prenup, but Gig ripped it up during the marriage to kind of be like, this marriage is for keeps. We don't need this. Big mistake.
Huge.
I'm going to go shopping now. So I hope you got that.
I love it.
So Elaine got a lot in the divorce settlement in terms of property and money, but she kept pushing for more and more child support. This dragged out for years, and it only made Gig resent her more and more. And eventually, he refused to even see his child and then denied Jennifer was even his.
I was going to ask you, like, what of baby Jennifer and Gig?
They were estranged after that.
Wow.
Super shitty. Elaine claimed she had never cheated on Gig. She said, he's the only guy I was with during that time. Jennifer can't possibly be anyone else's kid. And regarding his denial of parenthood, Elaine said, this was about something else. Gig delighted in making women suffer. He was cruel, sadistic. Beneath the charming facade, he hated women.
Yikes.
I mean, stemming from his childhood.
I was just going to say, we can make that connection back.
Yeah,
to...
I think there's truth to it.
Yeah.
Gig's lawyer advised him not to deny that Jennifer was his child because he'd already signed a paper during the divorce stating that she was. Mm. And his lawyer was like, you're not going to win this. And also, it's going to make people hate you, which is exactly what happened.
Oh, shit.
Jennifer was 6 when Gig came out saying he wasn't her dad and the public turned on him. You're really famous, you're in the public eye, and for the first 6 years of her life, you accepted that she was your daughter, and suddenly you turn your back on her? It's not a good look.
When you have to pay child support.
Exactly. And you're rich. Like, you have
wealthy, yeah.
You have a boat, you have a Jaguar, you have a Rolls Royce, you have a motorcycle. Like, come on. Gig then signed on to do a play, but again, his drinking was out of control. He had trouble, as he always did, learning his lines. That was always a problem for him. And he clashed with the cast and the production team. He also started changing some of the dialogue just on his own. The play was Harvey, Pulitzer Prize-winning drama. You don't go changing the lines, especially without discussing it with the production team first. So he was getting a reputation as being difficult to work with, and people were reluctant to hire him. He eventually developed neurodermatitis, which left him with itchy red blotches all over his face, believed to be brought on by emotional distress. So that's not going well for him.
My ankle.
Is it neurodermatitis? Kevin has a little skin situation on his foot.
I have patches on my ankle. Well, well, well.
Well, well, well.
Well, well, well.
Are you Gig reincarnated?
I mean, I've been stressed for months, so...
There it is.
Well, well.
Don't worry, everyone. He's got a cream for it.
An ointment.
An ointment.
That's weird. I'm sorry I brought that up.
I'm glad you did. Gig's next professional setback would prove to be his biggest. Mel Brooks was set to write and direct a film titled Black Bart, which would eventually be renamed Blazing Saddles.
Oh.
The studio cast Gig in the role of the Waco kid, much to the chagrin of Brooks, because Brooks didn't want him in the film, just based on everything he'd heard regarding Gig's drinking and being difficult to work with. So when he found out Gig was cast, he immediately fired him. But Warner Brothers was like, no, 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 Mr. Brooks, you have to have him in the role. So then Gig was rehired, which that already is going to mess with your head. You're hired, you're fired, you're rehired. Mel Brooks calls Gig up, and according to Gig, he said, quote, you better show up on Monday with every single line learned. You better be able to go through every scene without stopping. Like, I don't want any bullshit, essentially.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, fair.
Do your job.
Yeah. That's what you're hired to do. So Gig went hard memorizing his lines. He said he didn't sleep for the 3 days leading up to his first day on set because he was so nervous. When he showed up to set Monday morning, Brooks wanted him to watch the filming for a bit just to get a feel for the production. That was Kevin sneezing.
That came out of nowhere.
Did it? Because I saw you kind of rev up for it.
But I thought it was going to, you know how it comes and then you feel it kind of go. It kind of went, but then it just immediately came back. I'm so sorry.
It's okay.
Bless me.
Bless you.
No, it's...
I thought that was like a demand.
No.
Like, bitch, bless me.
Kate, say bless you. I'm going to die.
If you've ever been on a set, or even if you haven't, just know it is chaos. There are people everywhere, equipment moving around, lights, lots of lights, etc. And as Gig was walking through the set with Brooks, he started to feel dizzy, and he fell to the ground.
Ah, shit.
He started panting and crawling around, and the entire production just froze. Like, what do you do when this Oscar winner is just, like, crawling and panting along the floor? So everyone is staring at him. No one really knew what was going on. And Gig starts shouting, "Push on my head! Push on my head!" Which someone did. And once they did that, he felt a little better. So he crawled all the way and just tried to regain his composure as the production revved back up. The set medic came and checked him out. He starts feeling a little better, and Brooks says, "All right, if you're up for it, why don't you come and watch this next shot?" So Gig stands up, starts to follow Brooks yet again, and it happens again.
No.
He feels dizzy. He collapses to the ground. He begins wailing, "Ah!" like over and over. And again, he was shouting for someone to push on his head. So the medic took his blood pressure, and it was through the roof. So the production called an ambulance, and they were like, "Get him to the hospital right away." The doctor said he had hyperventilated. Some said it was the effects of his alcoholism that caused it. To me, it sounds like he had a panic attack.
I was going to say, yeah.
Which, given the circumstances and the pressure he was feeling to not screw up for Mel Brooks, makes sense. Unfortunately, the incident got him fired from the movie because they felt he was unfit to portray the role. And that part eventually went to Gene Wilder. To great acclaim. Gig actually sued Warner Brothers for breach of contract and was awarded 50% of what he was supposed to make. But Marty Baum, his former agent who got him the "They Shoot Horses, Don't They" film, he said Gig never fully recovered from the humiliation of being fired from the movie, especially after winning an Oscar. Mm-hmm. His self-esteem was just shot. And it gave people another reason to be like, see, he's unreliable, shouldn't hire him.
You're crazy.
The only roles being offered to him at that point were, like I said earlier, mostly alcoholics. That's all people saw him as.
That's sad.
Very sad.
That sucks.
Gig sought advice and help from a select group of people, none of which really had Gig's best interest at heart. There were three in particular that I'm going to talk about. The first was Dr. Eugene Landy, who is most famous for treating, air quotes, Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys. Mm. If you've seen the movie Love and Mercy, you haven't seen it?
No.
Oh, it's a good movie. Paul Giamatti plays Landy in the movie. Landy ended up basically taking over Brian Wilson's life and career. His whole thing was working with celebrities beyond a therapeutic level. It became managing the career and, of course, charging huge fees. Landy eventually had his license revoked, but at the time, Gig enlisted him to help him with learning lines for a TV series he'd been cast in. He felt he had a mental block and maybe therapy would help that. But Landy soon took over. He accompanied Gig to set every day, had lunch with him every day. He was always there. Mm. Then when he tried to tackle Gig's other problems, which included paranoia and sexual impotence, likely caused by Gig's dependence on alcohol and sedatives, Gig didn't want to face those issues, so he quit seeing Landy. The second person Gig turned to was vocal coach Bert Knapp. I'm putting vocal coach in air quotes. Vocal coach.
Vocal coach.
Gig met Knapp through Elaine Stritch years before and worked with him on musical comedy technique. Like Landy, Knapp had some famous clients, including Elaine Stritch, Mama Cass, and Walter Matthau.
Dang. And then you think of Elaine Stritch and, like, Company. And,
yeah,
like,
I mean, if she's your client, like, obviously you're going to be like, well, I will definitely take voice from her teacher.
But what was the catch?
The catch. Well, Gig idolized Knapp, and Knapp knew it. And over time, he became Gig's spiritual director / life coach / bad influence. And they recorded these
that's
sessions
quite
together.
A jump from vocal coach to life coach.
Yeah, that's why vocal coach is an air quote.
I'm going to take your voice and then I'm going to take your mind.
That's exactly what he was trying to do. So they would record these sessions together, and some of the tapes still exist, or at least did back when George Eales was writing the biography on him, because mm-hmm. he was able to use those for research, and he provides several transcripts in the book where you can read exactly what was going on during these sessions.
That was bananas.
Bananas!
Do you want to do dramatic readings of those sessions, Kate?
Oh, we should, but I don't have the book in here right now.
Fuck.
It's in the
another time.
Another time. It's on the dining table. Knapp was not a therapist, but he liked to think of himself as one. Unfortunately, I think he saw in Gig an opportunity to make a lot of money, and he knew he could prey on Gig's vulnerability, which is horrible.
Vulture.
Gig's obviously paying him for these sessions, and Knapp knew Gig would hang on every word. Mm-hmm. They would discuss Gig's childhood, the sexual abuse by Aunt Jessie, his resentment towards his family, vocal coach. And Knapp's therapeutic techniques, if you want to call them that, involved ridiculing Gig, calling him names, and eventually isolating him by persuading him to cut off his relationships with other business associates, including his longtime cheerleader, Marty Baum. Mm. He groomed him to be his devout follower,
yuck,
basically.
Ew. Ugh.
Then it looked like Gig's career might be on the upward swing again. Ooh. When he was offered a role in Arthur Miller's new play called The Archbishop's Ceiling in New York.
Oh, I don't know that one.
I don't either, and I think it was really bad. I don't think it's a
well. Oh.
Gig was thrilled, though. He was like, oh my God, it's Arthur freaking Miller. I can't believe it. And rehearsals went great. That is until the actors had to be off book and Gig could no longer carry his script around. Once again, he could not remember his lines.
Farts.
Gig turned to Bert Knapp, telling him he was worried that Arthur Miller might want him fired. And Knapp was basically like, well, if that's what you think, then yeah, Miller probably does want to fire you. This, of course, only lowered Gig's self-esteem further. And sure enough, the producers fired him from the play. So it was another devastating blow. And the third person Gig confided in towards the end of his life was Harriet Vine Douglas.
Because my brain is fried, I thought you were going to say Harriet Tubman. I was like, Kate, what?
What's going on?
What century is this? Sorry, continue.
Their relationship was an interesting one. She was in love with him, it seems, and they did have a quasi-romantic relationship, but people believe he was embarrassed by her because he was rarely seen out with her. If he had to attend some this is a word I never can say.
Publicity?
Yes. If he had to attend one of those events, he would ask a much younger woman to accompany him rather than Harriet. And Harriet was in her mid-50s, so she's actually kind of close to his age.
Oh, damn.
And I don't think he liked that.
Oh, that's not good.
But she didn't care how he treated her. She was there to cater to him, which he, of course, loved. But people who knew them both did not like her. They felt she had too much influence on his life. One person described her as a, quote, wishful thinking dreamer. Another described her as neurotic. She would clean his apartment, wash his dishes, do his laundry, you know, things a mother
I was gonna
might
say,
do
mommy,
for her son.
We talked, this is all he wants out of women, is
yes.
A mother.
And she became someone he confided in. No surprise here, she and Bert Knapp hated each other because they both wanted to be the most important person in Gig's life.
Ew, I hate them all.
Yes, you should. I do too. Gig was extremely insecure and an addict, unfortunately. He was seeing different doctors in order to get more and more prescriptions for pills. He became obsessed with his aging appearance. He was supposed to star in a project for Disney, which ended up falling through, and he believed it was because of his looks. And this is when he starts up with the plastic surgeries. First, he had surgery to remove the bags under his eyes, but something went... Your face right now. Say words. Use your words.
Use your words and say how you feel. I feel disgusted. What? Remove the bags from under your eyes? Wouldn't you just be like...
Well, like under here, he was having like the skin so that it would look all nice and firm. What happened was, I don't remember what they called it, but they described him as looking like Frankenstein's monster after that first.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, after that first surgery. And so something had gone wrong. He had to have another surgery to correct it.
That's how it all starts. One little itty bitty mistake I just keep saying itty bitty bitty
bitty. Itty bitty 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 bitty.
And then you have to keep it up. Like, yeah. You have to keep going to fix it to get it how you want.
Well, this is exactly what happened. So next he had all of his teeth recapped, which messed up his bite and made it painful for him to eat. And he'd get like hot spots or where, you know, it was really sensitive. So he had to have those spots ground down so that he could chew. Eventually, it became so painful that all he could eat was mashed potatoes and lettuce.
I mean, mashed taters is good.
I guess when I hear those two things together, I picture like a big old butter leaf lettuce with a pile of mashed potatoes on it.
With a schlop of mashed taters.
Yeah. To help deal with the pain, Gig increased his usage of sedatives.
God.
He ended up losing about 40 pounds because he simply couldn't eat. And he finally had his teeth recapped again. He was also experiencing numbness in his feet, which can be caused by a whole range of things, and Harriet encouraged him to get checked out at a hospital. On his first night there was an earthquake, and he freaked out. He began hyperventilating again and thought he was having a heart attack. Again, classic symptoms of a panic attack. He was diagnosed with circulatory issues and gallstones and had to have his gallbladder removed. During this time, he developed a deep fear of dying and kind of became obsessed with it. He also grew even more self-conscious about his looks and became pretty reclusive for about a year. Like, he just stopped going out. No one really saw him. And during this time, Harriet became his almighty protector again, a mother figure, and began to dictate who could see him and who couldn't. Like, Knapp, she was also trying to alienate him. Gig had more cosmetic procedures. He had his teeth redone for a third time, and he had more plastic surgery to lift his chin and his eyelids. He thought the changes made him look younger, but others felt he just didn't look like himself anymore.
Yeah, tends to happen when you start cutting your face up.
Nothing against plastic surgery. Like, you do you, do what makes you feel good. I think in his case, he was doing it it wasn't coming from a place of like, I look awesome and I want to look even more awesome. It was,
I have to fix this because everything's going down the hill.
Exactly.
Do you think I should get lip filler?
It's your body. You do what you want.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Gig was also convinced that he was being stalked by a tall, dark-haired man who wanted to murder him. And this was like a fear that was kind of always in the back of his mind. And because of that, he once again holed up in his apartment, only leaving when it was absolutely necessary and only if Harriet accompanied him. He wouldn't go anywhere alone. Gig decided, you know what? Maybe it's time to get away from things for a while. So he left L.A. And in October of 1977, he signed on to do the film Game of Death, shooting in Hong Kong. Game of Death was a film that starred Bruce Lee, but Lee died before the film was complete.
Oh.
So the production, it took a few years, but they took the footage already shot of Lee and created a new film around it. It was pretty controversial. A lot of actors didn't feel it was right to do that. They felt it was like a disservice to Bruce Lee.
Sure.
So in the new version, they would use body doubles in Lee's place when it was necessary. And Gig played Lee's best friend, which he said was really eerie considering Lee had died.
Oh.
It was during the filming of Game of Death that Gig met and fell in love with the script supervisor, a young blonde-haired woman named Kim Schmidt. In a lot of articles about this case, I don't feel like you get a lot of the background on Kim. You don't really get to know who she is. But I think George Eales did a really great job in this biography of kind of giving you as much information he could find. Mm-hmm. So we're going to talk about her. Kim was born Ruth Hannelore Schmidt in Schwalmstadt, Germany.
I like Germany.
I've never been.
I've been once. It was beautiful. I had the best time.
Great. Just kidding. Kim was the oldest of five kids, and at the age of six, she moved with her family to Australia. Even from a young age, Kim was really independent. She loved reading movie magazines and dreamed that one day she could make her way to Hollywood and make a name for herself. She graduated school at 16 and immediately moved to Melbourne, where she got an office job at 16, like out on her own, which is wild to me.
Melbourne.
Definitely shows how independent she was.
Yeah, good for her.
There she met her coworker, Judy Washington, and the girls were about the same age and quickly became the best of friends. Mm. When Judy turned 18, she moved to Hong Kong, and less than a year later, Kim followed. Hong Kong offered a ton of opportunity, and Kim loved it there. She loved the energy of the city, and she once said, "You can do anything here. Just print up a card. Here's my business card.
Here's
this is what I do.
Here's my card. Call me."
It was here that she changed her name to Kim from Ruth because she liked the way it sounded. She also wanted to change up her look, so she bleached her hair, got a tan. She started dieting like crazy. Yeah. Kind of like she was adopting that Hollywood image that she had in her mind. She was really outgoing and fun, and she wanted to soak up everything life had to offer. So when she broke up with this guy she'd been seeing, she thought, "I'm not going to sit here and mope. I'm going to travel the world. I'm going to see the sights." She went to Germany, where she worked as both an English teacher and a cocktail waitress. Then she went to Spain, where she was a DJ and a nightclub manager. Then she moved to London, where she worked first as a receptionist and then as a tour guide for a travel agency, which sounds like the coolest job because it basically entailed flying all over to places like the French Riviera and Mallorca and Italy. Did you see the movie with Lacey Chabert where she's in Rome and she's a tour guide?
Yes.
That's what I thought about
it. And then she starts her own tour guide company.
Yep.
Oh, I love that one.
And that's your drag name, Lacey Chabert.
Lacey Chabert. I forgot about it. See, I had already switched it over to Gigabyte.
Gigabyte.
But it's like G-I-G-A, new name, capital B-I-T-E. Giga.
Bytes. And you have a little.
Gigabytes.
Yeah. It was while working in Florence, Italy, that she began a romance with one of her regional managers named Gianni. The two were pretty serious, and Gianni invited her home to meet his family. But similar to Gig and Elaine Stritch, his family did not approve because she was of a different religious faith. Unfortunately, after that visit, the relationship ended. And it wasn't exactly a mutual parting. The two went back to Hong Kong to visit Kim's good friend Judy because she was sick at the time. Judy was fine later, but she just was feeling down, and so they went to visit her. And while there, Gianni left early to go back to Italy. He was like, "You know what? You stay here. Take care of your friend. I'll call you when I get home." And then he just never contacted her again.
That's shitty.
He just ghosted her.
Damn it.
The breakup left her feeling really low. She stayed with a couple of friends during this time, Russell Jones and his wife, Hai Tien. And Russell said that Kim could really go into a funk. He said, quote, "Her lows were very black. It was scary."
Yikes.
Hai Tien, Russell's wife, was really into the occult and told Kim she was living under dim stars and needed to lay low for a while to regroup, which Kim did. And once she started feeling like herself again, she got an apartment and a new job managing an artist co-op. She also started a newsletter called The Quorum that promoted the art scene in Hong Kong.
Wow. So what took her to Hong Kong?
Judy had moved there.
Judy moved there. Okay, okay, okay.
Was like, "Love it here. It's
come
the best."
Come over. Come
and,
see me.
And
yeah,
so
yeah,
Kim
yeah.
followed. Yep.
Got it, got it. Sorry.
This newsletter, The Quorum, that she started was a huge success. It made her a very well-known figure in town. She was often seen at parties. She was a prominent figure socially, always on the go, big into the art scene. And she was also working other jobs, including at an advertising agency and at the Hong Kong Trade Development Council. So she's really building that resume up.
Jesus. Good for her.
Yeah. Her co-worker, Andrew Simpson, said, quote, "Beneath Kim's vivacious exterior was a fiercely ambitious adversary who could get on colleagues' nerves with her nonstop go, go, go." He said if you told her one of her ideas was bad, she wouldn't speak to you for a week.
Wow.
Simpson said, quote, "She wouldn't attack, but she'd make life very difficult. When she was in that mood, doors would slam, she'd throw the presentation book around, she'd freeze you out. She could be very irritating." Kim was also very concerned about her public image. Like, even if she and her boyfriend were fighting behind closed doors, the second they stepped outside, it was all smiles and kisses. One of the men she dated in Hong Kong said she could make you feel like $1 million, but she could also be a pain in the ass if she didn't get her way. And she could be very persuasive. So much so that at one point, a man broke into her apartment while she was there and robbed her, then attempted to rape her.
Ah.
As he was beginning to take off his pants, she just started talking to him, trying to reason with him. Then she began intimidating him. Meanwhile, she's memorizing everything about his face and clothes.
Mm-hmm.
he eventually did leave without hurting her. Like, she talked him out the door and then immediately called the police and was able to describe him to a T that they had him arrested within 45 minutes.
Yeah.
And then in the mid-70s, she began an affair with a married man named Patrick Kelly, who was a film producer, and he asked her if she'd be interested in becoming a script supervisor. She was like, yeah, sounds cool. Suddenly, she's making twice what she had made at her job at that Trade Development Council. Mm-hmm. She was getting to travel all over for location shoots, and she was getting a taste of that Hollywood life. She loved it and said, this is the job for me. Her fella over there, Patrick Kelly, told her, yeah, actually, I think I'm going to try and be faithful to my wife, so I can't keep seeing you, but hey, let's keep up a business relationship. Kim was like, sure, totally, that's cool, cool, cool. But inside, she was distraught. She felt like she was a failure because none of the men in her life wanted to make a long-term commitment to her.
That doesn't make you a failure.
Of course not.
That's just men being
kind of
shitty.
Maybe like the relationship's just not right. Also,
right. And maybe she just hasn't found the right person.
Exactly. And also, Patrick was married, so there's that.
That's a big deal.
She often wrote down her thoughts in poems, and a poem she titled The Stranger Within, dated June 1977, gives a pretty revealing look at just how dark things seemed to her. And I do just want to give another warning here for mention of suicide. I'm just going to read part of it. She writes, "Oh, what a waste. Taking pills, drinking anything that's here. These are the best years of my life. I never looked better, never made more sense. Why am I crying? Just like a little kid, crying. Nobody loves me. Take a handful of sleeping pills, and in 20 minutes, it's all a dream."
Ugh.
Pretty dark. That same month, she wrote another poem when a different man she'd been seeing passed away. And this one is titled When Digby Died. Surprisingly, there's absolutely no mention of Digby in this poem. She writes, "Look at my face in the mirror. I am 30 years old. In 6 months, I'll be 31. What have I gained? Tonight, I got drunk deliberately because I had nothing better to do. Now I'm thinking about death, consumed by self-pity. I would kill myself, but I don't want pain. Anyway, that's too easy. Living is masochistic, so I punish myself by going on."
God.
So she's in a very
dark place.
Yes. 4 months later, Kim landed a new script supervising job on the film Game of Death, starring Gig Young. So now you know what kind of headspace both Kim and Gig were in when they met.
Oh, Jesus. This is not good.
No. Gig was immediately drawn to her because she reminded him of Elizabeth Montgomery. Not just in looks, but also in the way she behaved. She was really sociable and assertive. And despite being 33 years her senior, Gig began pursuing her. He called her constantly, sent her flowers, wrote her love notes. He love-bombed her. And of course, she was extremely flattered, not only because she was still feeling hurt that Patrick Kelly had left her, but also because Gig Young was one of her top five favorite actors. Remember, she'd been reading movie magazines since she was a kid. She fantasized about going to Hollywood. So here is this Oscar-winning actor pouring all this attention onto her. Yeah, of course she's going to fangirl all over him. That's going to be incredibly enticing. Who wouldn't be into that? They began dating. And Kim was so excited. She called up her good friend Judy Washington to be like, "You will never guess who I'm dating." She said, "I feel so lucky. He's so wonderful, except he drinks too much." She said, and this is a quote, "He needs looking after, and I am just the person to do it."
Yikes.
So despite being decades younger than him, Kim, like so many other women in his life, took on a motherly role towards Gig. When he had trouble learning his lines, she encouraged him to lay off all the pills he was taking, which he did, but this only caused him to drink more. Kim's dad had been an alcoholic, and she didn't want to see Gig go down the same path. So she would have talks with him about how destructive the alcohol was, and he knew it was an important issue to her.
I just know this isn't going anywhere good.
No. Most of our episodes don't. Kim was crazy about Gig, and the two of them were very out in the open about their relationship. They didn't try to hide it. They were very lovey-dovey on the set of Game of Death, and she was telling people how madly in love with him she was. But despite her devotion to him, his insecurities were never far from the surface.
Yeah.
He felt awkward hanging out with her friends because they were so much younger. And the more their relationship grew and the more maternal she was toward him, the more difficulty he had maintaining a sexual relationship. So he worried he couldn't satisfy her.
Don't fuck your idols.
Don't even meet your idols, honestly. Yeah. Don't meet your heroes. That's what they say.
I don't think I have heroes. Do you have heroes?
I
don't know that I idolize anyone that much.
Yeah, I don't
Is that
think
bad?
I do. No.
I respect people and what they do, but I don't aspire to be someone.
No.
I mean, some other person. I want to be a person.
Thank you for clarifying.
Thanks. All this talk, all these poems, I'm like spiraling.
Oh, no, Kevin, come on, bring it back.
Bring it back. Gather yourself. Hang on, let me get my gathering pose.
Then her ex-lover, Patrick Kelly, called her up, offering her a job on a film that would be shot in Manila. Well, Gig didn't like this one bit. He was so jealous. Mind you, he remained friends with several of his ex-lovers, Betty Davis, Sky Aubrey, Elaine Stritch. But he couldn't handle it when his partner did the same.
That's bullshit.
Whenever Patrick's name came up, Gig would become real moody, like he had this dark cloud hanging over him.
Pouty bitch.
He wanted Kim all to himself. So he started laying on the flattery pretty thick, telling her it was she who had helped him overcome his dependency on drugs and alcohol, and he was a new man, all thanks to her. He needed her around because she's the only person making it possible for him to control his substance abuse. He's not drinking anymore, and it's all thanks to her. Very manipulative.
Whoa. That's harsh. That's too much.
Yeah. And of course, she's like, well, of course I'll stay with you. I can't leave you while you're doing so well. She didn't want him to have a setback, so she turned down Patrick's job offer. Then one day while Gig was out, Kim was in his hotel room. They're still in Hong Kong. And a hotel employee stopped by and told Kim, hey, I'm here to restock the vodka in the minibar. And Kim said, oh, I think you have the wrong room. And he said, no, this is definitely the right room. I've been restocking the vodka in here daily.
He's drinking again.
She was pissed. Yeah. So she just sat there and waited for Gig to get in. And when he did, they got into a huge fight, and he admitted that he had indeed been sneaking vodka into his orange juice every day. She was livid. They had a horrible fight, and he kicked her out of his room.
Mm. Ooh, I want a vodka orange now.
That's the wrong takeaway from this message.
No, I know. But you just saying vodka orange made me think, tasty.
Gig even told the front desk not to put any calls for him through, to just take messages, and he'd return the calls he needed to. And he did not call Kim. After several days went by and she still hadn't heard from him, she thought, I don't need this. Screw it. So she went out on a date with another guy. His name was Elliot Bass, and he was from America, and she mentioned how she longed to go to America, telling him her dream was to become a celebrity, and she felt the U.S. was the only place to do it. She had big stars in her eyes, which was interesting to me that even back then, there was this, like, huge idealism or, like, romanticizing of celebrity, because today, for sure, I think people romanticize it, but if you've listened to even one episode of this podcast, you know celebrity does not solve your problems.
Yet.
In fact, it probably makes them worse.
It makes it 100 times worse.
Yes. Kim's involvement with Elliot didn't really go any further past that date, and she still hadn't heard from Gig, despite that they are still working together on Game of Death. They just ignored each other on set. Awkward.
That's crazy. Bananas, one might say.
One might say. As she had done in the past, Kim sought refuge in the apartment of her friends, Russell and High Tian Jones. Kim's friends were glad that she and Gig were no longer seeing each other. They never felt the two were a good match. They were like, whatever you do, don't get back together with him.
It's interesting that when you said that Kim had stars in her eyes, it made me think when High Tian told her that her stars were dim.
Dim. Oh, look at you making those connections. And Kim said, you know what? You're right. He's way too old for me. He's an alcoholic. It can never work.
Mm-hmm.
But then Gig called her.
Ah.
He was all, I've been so depressed and lonely without you. I miss you. Can we talk? And Kim, she just couldn't say no to him. They began seeing each other again. Again, he's a big star. He's showering her with praise. I can see why it would be hard for her to say no to that. And when her friends voiced their concerns, Kim said, I can't help it. He needs me.
He needs help, not... Like, he needs, like, professional help from somebody who's not going to try to take advantage of him.
Exactly.
Or need something from him, because she's obviously getting something from him, needing to be needed is a thing. It's called codependency. And when you go down that road, it's basically like taking advantage of each other in a weird kind of emotional manipulative way.
And it gets manipulative,
Yeah, exactly. She's getting something from him for herself by swooping in and like taking care of him. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally makes sense. Gig's New York agent, Archer King, sent him a script for the play Long Day's Journey Into Night, being done back in the States at the University of Memphis, and Gig was invited to perform as a guest artist. Seeing this as an opportunity for her to go to the U.S., Kim encouraged Gig to take the role. And he said, okay, but only if you'll come with me and help me with my lines.
He can't do a fucking play. He can't do a fucking play.
Yeah, and we're gonna see how it all turns
just
out.
Just turns to shit.
So Kim was thrilled, but then her ex, Patrick Kelly, came creeping again.
Ew!
And offered her a very high-paying job as unit publicist on a film he was gonna be shooting in the Philippines. So now she's not sure what to do. Take the big paycheck, the sure thing, or head to the U.S. where she has no job lined up, but she's with Gig, and she's in the U.S.
Philippines.
Well, she turned to her friend, Hai Tien, for advice. And remember, Hai Tien was really spiritual, very into the occult. So she looked over the astrological charts and warned Kim not to go to the Philippines. She told her something bad is going to happen there. So with that warning, Kim chose the U.S. with Gig. A few months later, when Patrick was in the Philippines scouting locations, the helicopter he was in hit an electrical wire and crashed, killing everyone on board.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Gig and Kim landed in New York City, and she immediately fell in love with the place. He introduced her to all his friends and associates, which included vocal coach / wannabe therapist Bert Knapp. And Knapp loved Kim. He told her she was the best thing that ever happened to Gig.
Shut up.
Gig got to work studying his role in the play, while Kim spent her time sightseeing and shopping, all of which Gig was more than happy to pay for. By the time they flew to Memphis for rehearsals, Gig was nowhere near prepared enough for the job. He did not have his lines memorized.
Yep.
And you think of all the students who have been studying, preparing for this show, and they're excited because they're going to get to work with this Oscar winner. And then the guy shows up and he's not up to the task. In Gig's defense, it's an extremely difficult role because there's so much repetition in it. But no matter what he tried, he just couldn't get the lines down. In a letter Kim wrote to her friend Judy back in Hong Kong, she said, quote, "Fantasy, fantasy. I find myself completely at home in my role, which consists of making sure Gig doesn't forget his glasses, making sure he remembers to wear clothes that match. He's the original absent-minded professor type. At night, when we study lines from midnight to 3 a.m., I make him learn the words and explain the story to him so he gets into it more. I'm directing his performance more than the director of this play. Gig says no one has ever given him more tricks to learn and remember pages of dialogue." But he wasn't getting his lines. That's the thing. And according to the director, Henry Swanson, Kim's advice was actually doing more harm than good because it contradicted directions Swanson, the director, would give. So Swanson, the university's acting teacher, Joanna Helming, who also co-starred with Gig in the play, as well as all the students involved, were at their wits' end. Finally, Swanson asked Kim to step aside, and she was pissed. She didn't have any theater experience, and they were like, what are you doing here? And Gig was like, hey, they're right. I need someone coaching me who actually knows what they're doing. And I think her ego was bruised a bit. She and Gig got into a huge fight over the whole thing, and he kicked her out of their hotel room, because that's his thing. He just kicks the woman out. The show ended up as a bit of a disaster. On opening night, the runtime was 45 minutes shorter than it was supposed to be because Gig just forgot chunks of the script. Imagine being one of the actors in that show constantly trying to figure out like where you are and what's coming next because he's just like in his own play. Gig's agent, Archer King, that had gotten him the job, had flown in to see the show, but didn't even stick around afterwards. It was that bad.
I mean, this is just like a downward spiral that doesn't get better.
Yeah. After Memphis, things between Kim and Gig grew increasingly volatile. People that knew both of them got the feeling that Kim was only using Gig as a means to an end. The two would fight, they'd break up, they'd kiss, they'd make up, they'd sing Katy Perry. They were constant highs and lows.
I got the eye of the tiger, a fighter.
But Gig, despite failures in his previous marriages, felt like if he was going to be with Kim, they should get married. So he proposed. She did not want to marry him.
Good.
She said, how about we just live together?
Yeah.
This led to more fighting. And in steps old Bert Knapp, who, with Gig's encouragement, convinces Kim to stay with Gig no matter what. Marriage, no marriage, doesn't matter. He told her, quote, you need to build his ego, make him feel important as only a woman can.
Boo, no, blech. Stop, get away.
Vomit.
Knapp. Take a nap, Knapp.
And the reason he was so determined to keep the two of them together is because Kim liked Knapp and always encouraged Gig to listen to whatever he had to say.
No.
Which meant Gig would keep paying him. If Gig and Kim split, Knapp worried that Gig might get closer to Harriet Vine Douglas, who hated Knapp and could potentially turn Gig against him. And then there goes his paycheck.
God.
He was not looking out for Gig. He was looking out for himself.
Well, yeah.
Once again, Kim fell into the role of mother and cheerleader, and Gig was like, hey, I think this could work. He said to her, babe, let's go to Hong Kong, get all your stuff. I'm moving you to the States for good. And she said, okay, but just to live together, right? Like, no marriage, cool, cool, cool. And he was like, yeah, totally. They went to Hong Kong. It was New Year's Eve, and they had a blast. Both got insanely drunk.
Yeah.
But
also, no.
He's an alcoholic,
yes,
so no.
No.
They were seemingly happy. She packed up all her belongings. She had her suitcases ready to go in the corner of her apartment. And the day before they were scheduled to leave, Gig proposed again. She was like, dude, let's just live together. Jeez. So he gave her an ultimatum, the hallmark of any lasting relationship. He said,
ultimatums. That's really funny. Sorry.
He said, if you won't marry me, then you can forget about New York. Forget about New York. And he left and went back to the States without her. It was while in New York without Kim that Bert Knapp got it into his head to convince him he had to have Kim in his life.
Okay. Yeah.
So.
Great.
As usual, Gig called her over and over until he won her back and she moved to New York. Gig asked his agent, Archer King, to find an apartment for him and Kig.
Kig. That's the celebrity
That's their
name.
Kig.
Kig.
To find an apartment for them to move into. And King found a one-bedroom unit in Midtown Manhattan at the Osborne, one of the oldest luxury apartment buildings in the city. It's right across from Carnegie Hall. Leonard Bernstein actually lived there for several years prior to Gig and Kim moving in, and it's where he was living when he wrote West Side Story. Fun fact.
Oh.
Gig paid what in today's time would be about $322,000 for the place, which for New York is a great deal. And the reason he got such a good price is because the unit needed extensive repairs, like a lot of work. When he discussed this with the woman who owned the place before him, she just had one request, that he not disturb the nice ghosts that she believed lived there. He was like, ghost schmost, what? That doesn't make any sense. It wasn't long before the cost of all those repairs added up. The place had to be essentially gutted. New wiring, new plumbing, a new bathroom had to be installed twice because it wasn't done correctly the first time. The brand new carpeting had to be ripped out and replaced because the plasterers hadn't adequately covered it when they were working. The bills ran into the thousands. Meanwhile, his trusted advisor, Bert Knapp, had taken on a new vocal student, a singer named Patrick Shields, who was quickly becoming Knapp's new favorite. Shields managed an elite restaurant and nightclub in Manhattan, aptly named Le Club. Its members included...
Le Club!
Le Club. Its members included George Steinbrenner, who owned the Yankees, the Kennedys, the Vanderbilts, and Donald Trump. One day, kind of as a joke, Shields said to George Steinbrenner, hey, it should be me up there singing the national anthem before the Yankees game. And Steinbrenner said, no, you should be singing in a grand concert hall. Like, he was sincere about this. So as a birthday gift to Shields, Steinbrenner rented a hall and organized an evening with Patrick Shields. Knapp helped Shields with all his songs. They asked Gig to introduce him at the event. And as the evening was getting closer, Shields went to Knapp and said, "Hey, can you just make sure Gig keeps his introduction short? Like, these people are coming to see me, not him. Like, I want to make sure he knows his role here." And Knapp said, "Absolutely, I will totally tell him that, for sure, for sure." But he forgot. On the evening of the concert, Gig showed up completely drunk. And when he went on stage to introduce Shields, he had pages upon pages of notes. So he's just up there rambling on. The audience got pissed and they started shouting to get on with the show. And finally, Shields comes out, but turns out he had never sung in public before and he wasn't very good. Like, he kind of sucked.
Oh, I wish I could have been there. This is riveting.
The event was a complete shit show. And a bunch of Knapp students quit taking lessons from him as a result.
Yeah.
Because when you're the vocal coach and your student sucks, doesn't look great for your teaching abilities.
Oh, I love the downfall of Knapp.
Knapp blamed it all on Gig. And in retaliation, Knapp severed all ties with him.
Good.
Just cut him off cold turkey. He refused to take Gig's calls. He ignored him when he came by the studio. And this is the man that Gig had abandoned a lot of his business associates for. The one man he entrusted with some of the most intimate details of his life, who has just turned his back on him. Mm-hmm. He told Kim he needed to get away. So in the summer of 1978, they headed to Canada. Before leaving, Kim got word from her friends Russell and Heitzie and Jones that they were going to be spending the summer in New York. And Kim said to Gig, "Hey, why don't we lend our place to the Joneses while we're in Canada? They can look after things." And Gig was like, "Yeah, sounds great." After the first few days of staying in the apartment, Russell developed flu-like symptoms and was having some respiratory issues. He attributed it to poor ventilation because the air conditioning was malfunctioning in the unit. Mm-hmm. And despite the 20-foot-high ceilings in the living room, Russell said it was claustrophobic because there were no windows in the entire room. Not only that, the apartment itself only had two windows total, if you could even call them that. They faced a brick wall and had bars on them, so you quite literally felt like you were in prison. Mm. And the artificial lighting inside the unit was pretty dim, so it just felt dark and closed in. And there, you're not getting daylight. Russell said you couldn't tell what time of day it was or what the weather was like. Maybe it was sunny and beautiful. Maybe it was cloudy and gray. Who knows? A few days later, a friend of Hai Tian's called. His name was Professor Lin Yun. He's described as a mystic and a practitioner of feng shui. They invited him over to the apartment, and as soon as he walked in, he said, "There's a malevolent presence here." And he told Hai Tian, quote, "There is very, very bad luck in here. It is very bad for the man of the house." Yun suggested that the bed in the bedroom be repositioned and that mirrors be installed to help open the place up, because I guess they didn't even have mirrors on the wall. So you just...
Weird.
It's just like walls and just dim
walls
lighting.
And bars and...
But the Joneses felt weird about redecorating a place that wasn't theirs, so instead they packed up their stuff and got a hotel.
Fair enough.
They wrote Kim and Gig and were like, "So, thanks for the accommodations, but your place gives us the creeps, so we left." They mentioned what Professor Yun had said, and Kim took it very seriously and wanted to do as he'd suggested. But Gig said, "Feng shui is just a bunch of hocus pocus, doesn't mean anything."
Feng shui, shmeng shui.
Meanwhile, in Canada, he was working on the play Nobody Loves an Albatross and wanted to mount a whole national tour in the U.S., but when he approached his agent about it, King wasn't interested. He'd already seen what a disaster the show at University of Memphis had been. And he told Gig, "Hey, you just kind of need to lay low, like wait for a part that's really good that can help boost your career." He was like, "This tour you want to put together, isn't it?"
"No, bitch, you can't do theater."
That was the subtext of his message. Well, Gig didn't like that answer. And he fired King right then and there. And that was the end of their relationship.
All right.
Gig became fixated on this albatross play. He was workshopping it at this little dinner theater in Canada, but it wasn't very good. The cast wasn't great, and Gig wasn't that good in it.
Yeah.
He became convinced that he just needed a better director. So he invited his friend Bob Douglas to come and see it, and Douglas obliged. But he also felt it wasn't very good, and afterwards went to dinner with Gig and Kim and said he wasn't interested. When the bill came, Gig asked him for his wallet. And she's like, you have it. And he said, no, I definitely gave it to you. So they get into a fight. And Douglas is like, I'll just pay the bill. I don't want to like create a scene here. Yeah. Back at the inn where they were staying, Gig and Kim are sitting on the couch and Kim runs her hand on the inside of the cushion and pulls out Gig's wallet. And she's like, well, here it is. And she also found two large pills in the cushion, which Gig grabbed and took to the bathroom. The next day, Douglas and the couple went out to lunch and once again, Gig forgot his wallet. And again, Gig was trying to convince Douglas to direct the play, but Douglas said no. He was like, it's not good. I don't want to direct it. And Gig said, well, why don't you come see it tonight? And Douglas said, I saw it last night, remember? And Gig said, oh, well, see it again. Weird.
Mm.
So Douglas agreed. The three of them were in Gig and Kim's suite at the inn getting ready, and Gig went on to the theater ahead of them. And before Douglas and Kim left to go, Douglas asked to use the restroom. And he was pretty disturbed by what he saw in there. He said, quote, I'm not exaggerating when I say Gig had to have had a double table to hold all the pills.
Whoa.
All over were bottles of pills. Little bottles, big bottles. Bottles, bottles, bottles.
Blue bottles, green bottles. Bottles, bottles, bottles.
So many bottles.
I was trying to make it Dr. Seuss-like.
Oh.
It didn't work. Yeah, Kate's like, yeah, sure. Mm-hmm.
So Douglas comes out of the bathroom and asks Kim, why are there so many pills in there? And she said, oh, he's taking a lot of pills. One doctor says one thing, another something else. And Douglas said, it's like a pharmacy in there. But she just kind of brushed him off. Despite Gig's pleas, Douglas refused to work on the play with him and advised him to drop it, find another project. But Gig was so fixated on it, he couldn't let it go, which is ironic given the name of the play. He and Kim returned from Canada to their apartment at the Osborne on September 12th, 1978. And even though they weren't married, Gig was introducing Kim as his fiance by that point. And she still hadn't agreed to marriage. She wrote to her parents that she worried marriage would ruin their relationship. And as an example, she said that one day while they were still in Canada, they were in their suite and turned on the TV and Bewitched was on. And Kim was looking at Gig waiting for a reaction. And all he said was, she's as phony an actress as she is a woman.
I thought he was going to say, that bitch made me eat dog food.
That too. So Kim was like, see, that didn't end well. So I don't know that marriage is like the right thing. Meanwhile, Harriet Vine Douglas wasn't finished with Gig.
Harriet Vine Douglas, my ass.
She wasn't finished with Gig, and apparently he wasn't done with her yet either. He called her constantly. Whenever he had a complaint about Kim, he was dialing Harriet. She thought Kim was just a phase he was going through, and she told him not to marry her, just live with her and get it out of his system without another costly divorce. But as it looked like Gig had no plans of getting rid of Kim, Harriet began threatening her. According to Kim, Harriet was calling Kim constantly, warning her not to marry Gig and threatening to sue to have herself declared Gig's common law wife. But Kim was like, you two never even really lived together, so not sure how you're going to prove that one. Harriet also spread rumors about Kim that she was bisexual, which even if she was, like, so?
Sure.
And that she was, quote, militant. And when asked to explain this, Harriet just said, you know, guns. That was her response.
Guns.
You know. And it's interesting because I didn't read anything about Kim having an interest in guns, but Harriet did. She and her husband, because, yes, she was married, they owned guns. And once a while back, Gig was visiting them, and so he got interested in guns while he was there, and he began doing target practice, and he ended up owning four himself, four guns. And when he moved into the Osborne, he phoned Harriet in California asking her to send his furniture and those four guns to New York. But despite Harriet's wishes and Kim's initial reluctance, Gig and Kim did get married. They had a simple wedding ceremony at City Hall on September 27th, and when a reporter found out about the ceremony and tracked the couple down to get a statement from Gig, all Gig said was, don't make a big thing of it. So, doesn't exactly sound like wedded bliss.
Nope, not at all.
Money was a big issue for the couple because neither of them were working.
Right.
Kim didn't seem to have any plans to get a job. She was focused on helping Gig with his career. But he was so determined to get this fucking albatross play going that he wasn't pursuing any other projects. Plus, he had dropped his agent, so there weren't a lot of people left in his corner.
It sucks that Kim is, like, losing herself in this guy.
Yeah.
This, like, person who really just can't get it together.
No. They took the Joneses out to dinner while they were still in town. But Gig was all moody because he couldn't get a producer for the Albatross play. So Russell, in an attempt to lighten things up, said, well, what's so great about acting anyway? Ugh. Gig went off.
Ballistic.
He jumped up. He grabbed Russell by the lapels of his coat and said, I'll show you what's so great about acting. And everyone at the table was just like, what is happening? And then Gig just let go and sat down and smiled and said, that's what's so great about acting.
Yeah, I think he was trying to mask a shitty reaction.
Exactly, because he was prone to violent outbursts.
Right, we've seen this throughout.
Mm-hmm. He was also becoming more and more concerned about aging. He'd often ask Kim to pluck his ear hairs, which when you're 31 and a newlywed, it's likely going to put a damper on the love life. And Gig was very self-conscious that he was unable to perform sexually.
If anybody wants me to pluck their ear hairs, I'm down, y'all.
Oh, you're into it.
Come on, bring it on. Let's get into each other.
Are you also a pimple popper?
Yes.
Oh, I knew you would be.
Let's pop those pimples. Let's pull those hairs. Got some ingrowns? I'll get it for you.
Oh.
I sound like a troll. I actually am a troll.
You kind of looked like one there, too. You're like, rah. Gig was also contemplating more plastic surgery.
No, Gig.
Nevertheless, outwardly at least, Kim seemed completely devoted to him. Anytime they'd have dinner with friends, Kim and Gig were always observed acting very cuddly toward one another, giving each other little kisses here and there. But behind closed doors, neither seemed very happy. Kim seemed upset that her marriage to the actor didn't get more publicity. In a letter to her friend Judy Washington, written shortly after the wedding, Kim wrote that she'd bought a movie magazine in Central Park and said, quote, I looked at the pictures first in case I was in it, but no. She doesn't mention wanting to see if she and Gig were in it. She's just like, I looked to see if my picture was in the magazine, but it wasn't.
Why would it be at this point?
She thought that, you know, he was still hot shit.
Not at all, honey.
But she also told Judy how generous and considerate Gig was and admitted that she had not exactly been a great girlfriend to the men in her previous relationships. She wrote, quote, no more being the moody bitch. With Gig, I find I can actually stop it and be nice and fun to be around. I have been very selfish in a very hard to live with way with all the past live-in lovers. It's a wonder anyone stuck around. Yet neighbors at the Osborne claimed to hear what they described as loud and nasty arguments coming from apartment 1BB that the Young shared. Gig had made a habit of retreating to the basement to the office of the building's manager, Constas Matsoukas. Since he didn't have Bert Knapp to tell his problems to anymore, Matsoukas became his replacement, in a way. Matsoukas said, quote, he'd talk to me like I was his psychiatrist. I didn't understand half the things he was telling me, but he was a nice man. A very, very nice man.
Oh, well, that's nice.
On Friday, October 13th.
Friday the 13th.
Mm-hmm, Kim wrote to Judy stating how proud she was of Gig for not having had a drink of vodka in 8 months. Just wine. And how the two of them were each taking, quote, about 100 vitamins a day for our brains, bodies, and psyches. That's too many vitamins.
Too many vitamins. That, their pee was like glowing yellow. You know what I'm talking about.
I know exactly.
You know exactly what I'm...
Was it the vitamin E or what was it that makes it glow? Zinc?
I forget. I think it might be. It's like some of those multivitamins.
Yeah.
I just imagine like
a neon
a light coming out of their toilet.
And when she says like, oh, he's just drinking wine, Gig could drink about a bottle and a half of wine at dinner. So that's not exactly being
I mean,
off
you're
the
just
alcohol.
Replacing an alcohol with another alcohol. Mm-hmm. That's not making it better.
Right. So that same day, Friday the 13th, Gig called up Elaine Stritch, who now lived in London with her husband, John. But the two of them were in New York visiting. And Elaine suggested he and Kim join her and John for breakfast the next day. Gig showed up, but Kim didn't. And Gig didn't offer any explanation as to why not.
Hmm.
Elaine could tell something was bothering Gig, but when she asked what was wrong, he just said, I don't know. She encouraged him to get back into AA, telling him he'd find some really nice people there, he'd make some friends, and he seemed to consider it. At the end of the meal, the three of them hugged and made plans to meet the next afternoon at 4:30 p.m. for tea, just to say goodbye before Elaine and John sailed back to London at 6 o'clock. The next day comes, but Gig didn't show. Elaine and John waited and waited, but Gig never came, and eventually they had to board the boat.
Yeah.
On Monday, October 16th, Gig was back in the basement in Matsuka's office talking about his relationships with women. He talked a lot about Sophie Rosenstein and Elaine Stritch and said that they were the only two women he'd ever truly loved. Matsuka's later said he got the feeling that Kim had only married Gig to get into Hollywood, saying, quote, she loved the parties, the publicity.
I mean, yeah.
On Tuesday, October 17th, Gig and Kim met with PR agent Cy Preston, along with Roz Starr, who often booked celebrities for like TV shows and charity events and that kind of thing. And Roz offered the Youngs a honeymoon cruise. She was like, hey, I can give you guys a cruise for free. You'll actually get paid. It's got tons of perks. And all you do, Gig, is like you'll be the entertainment for the passengers. And you just need to spend 45 minutes talking about Hollywood. Easy peasy gig. And it's yours.
Gig.
Oh, yeah. I did say easy. Yep. Sure did. Gig and Kim.
Gig.
Gig and Kim.
The power couple, Gig.
Gig. Gig seemed thrilled, but Gig said, I don't want to book anything just yet. See, I'm trying to get this Albatross play up and running.
Stop it with the plays.
Yes.
Stop it with the plays, Gig.
Roz and Cy noted that the couple were very affectionate with one another during the dinner, all snuggled up together. But then when Roz dropped them off at their apartment afterwards, they're both smiling, waving goodbye. And as soon as Roz pulled away, Kim immediately turned and went inside while Gig was still standing there waving. Roz noted it was odd, like a switch had flipped.
Mm.
Earlier that day, according to Harriet Vine Douglas, Gig had called Harriet complaining that Kim was pressuring him to make changes in his will. A few months prior, Gig had changed his will, leaving half his estate to Kim and the other half to his sister Jen. He also left $7,500 to Harriet and a measly $10 to his daughter, Jennifer, who he'd abandoned.
Not yet.
He didn't even want to leave her that, but said he only did it as a legal technicality so that the will couldn't be contested. And he left his Oscar to his former agent, Marty Baum, who'd played such a pivotal role in him getting the part that led to him winning the award. Well, Kim took it upon herself to revise his will. And showed Gig the new version that Tuesday. And in her version, Harriet and Jen were completely cut out. Like, I can understand wanting Harriet out, but Jen is his sister. Like, that is the most important family member he has. Jen had noticed that although Kim seemed friendly toward her at first, she had grown resentful soon after the wedding. Like, anytime there was communication, Jen just felt something was off.
Mm.
Gig refused to sign this new version, thankfully.
Good. Something.
Something. He was also struggling because he hadn't been sleeping that week. Kim had very proudly convinced Gig to cut out the sedatives and alcohol, which it seems he tried to do cold turkey. He usually took 5 or 6 sleeping pills a night to fall asleep, and now he wasn't taking anything. So he's not sleeping. On Wednesday, October 18th, Kim happened to run into Cy Preston, that PR agent from the night before.
Mm-hmm.
She saw him on the street and she happily waves and then randomly says, I'm so disappointed that my marriage to Gig didn't make Time Magazine's milestones column. Being in publicity, is there anything you can do? And Cy was just kind of like, what? Such an odd thing to say to an acquaintance you've just met the night before. So we're seeing what her mindset is.
It feels like it's devolved completely into insanity.
That evening, Gig phoned Harriet, who was in L.A., and he told her he'd made a mistake marrying Kim. He was humiliated. This was his 5th marriage. If they divorced, it'd be his 4th divorce. He asked Harriet to come to New York and take him back to California with her. Harriet told him she didn't want to run the risk of going all the way to New York only for him to decide to stay with Kim. She's like, I'm not going to, you know, be a laughingstock. I'm not going to do that. And he said, won't you reconsider? And she said no, and they said goodbye. And that was the last time Harriet ever spoke to Gig. The next morning, Thursday, October 19th, 1978, Gig called down to the doorman to ask what the weather was like, because he can't tell from his apartment since there's no windows.
There were no windows.
The doorman said Gig gave the impression he was in a hurry and getting ready for an appointment, but he never left the apartment that day. Around noon, Kim called the Grenoble Market and placed an order for groceries totaling $23.30. Mm-hmm. Between 2:30 and 3:30 p.m., Matsoukas was in his apartment on the second floor enjoying his lunch break, when at some point during this hour, he heard two loud bangs. His first thought was, those sound like gunshots. But he told himself it was probably just noise caused by a handyman he'd hired to break up some windows, so he went on eating his lunch. When his break was over, he headed back down to his office in the basement, which meant he had to pass through the lobby next to apartment 1BB. He noticed two bags of groceries sitting outside the door, and he was a little annoyed because they contained perishables, including milk and lettuce, and Gig was not the type of man to just leave groceries lying around. He asked the doorman if they'd seen either Gig or Kim, but they said the Youngs had not left the apartment that day.
Mm.
Matsoukas then called them, but no one answered. By 5:30, when there was still no sign of the couple and the groceries were still sitting outside, Matsoukas was beginning to think those bangs had not been the sounds of windows being broken up after all. When Mike Stimmen, president of the Co-op Association, arrived home to the building, Matsoukas told him he suspected he'd heard gunshots, and Stimmen said, well, use your key and go check it out. And Matsoukas said, I'm not going to go check it out, you go check it out. At which point, Stimmen said, let's just call the police.
Let's just call the police.
At 7:25 p.m., officers arrived at the Osborne. Outside of the Young's door, they ordered anyone inside come out with their hands over their heads. There was no response. When they entered the unit, they could tell by the smell the place had been freshly painted, and there was a check written out to the painter on a table in the entryway. The apartment was very tidy and clean. Nothing looked as though it had been disturbed. They checked the kitchen, den, and sitting room, but nothing was out of the ordinary. It's just like this paint smell, and again, there's no ventilation, so you just think about all the renovations that have been going on, mm-hmm. all the dust in there, the paint, there's no light, there's no window, there's no ventilation. When officers reached the bedroom, they discovered a gruesome scene. Mm. Both Gig and Kim were dead on the floor, each from a single gunshot wound. A news article I read stated Kim was lying face down, but in the biography it says she was lying on her back.
Mm-hmm.
And that news article had some other incorrect information, so I tend to trust the biography more.
Mm-hmm.
She had been shot from behind at the base of her skull. Lying next to her was Gig. He was face down. A .38 caliber pistol was in his right hand, and the bullet that killed him had entered through his mouth and exited the back of his head. During their investigation, police found multiple sexually explicit magazines along with several erotic Polaroid photographs of Gig and Kim that had been taken using an automatic timer. They found just two bottles of wine in the apartment and approximately 100 bottles of vitamins, all different kinds. They also found 7 oxazepam pills. Oxazepam is a sedative used to treat anxiety as well as the symptoms of alcohol withdrawal.
Mm.
Side effects include paranoia and suicidal ideation. On the desk in the sitting room was an appointment book, and it was open to September 27th. And on that date, in Gig's handwriting, all that was written were the words, "We got married today." And there were no other entries after that.
That's yucca.
For detectives, it was a pretty cut and dry case of a murder-suicide. But some of the couple's friends refused to believe that Gig would do this on purpose. Some thought maybe he was showing Kim the gun and it went off by accident. Mm-hmm. And then, distraught, he turned the gun on himself. Others thought someone must have come in and murdered them both. But there was no forced entry. Nothing had been stolen. Kim was wearing expensive clothes and jewelry, all accounted for. Gig's Oscar was displayed right there in the room. It hadn't been touched. And the way Gig's right hand was clutching the gun, detectives called that the death print. He took his life by putting the gun in his mouth, and when he pulled the trigger, it caused his hand to spasm, and then rigor mortis sets in. And the way the trigger was implanted in his fingers, it created ridges that wouldn't have appeared there if someone had planted the gun in his hand. So from a medical standpoint, those ridges could not have been present unless Gig had pulled the trigger. He did not leave a suicide note. People still didn't want to believe it, though. Some said he didn't own any guns, but he owned four. And some said he wouldn't even know how to shoot one, but he went to target practice. And according to his autopsy, there were no barbiturates or alcohol in his system.
Oh.
So some believed he was experiencing psychosis due to withdrawal.
Mm-hmm.
There was one theory that the couple had been murdered because of some kind of sketchy incident in Kim's past. And I couldn't find details on that. And Kim's parents didn't believe that Gig could have killed her. They also believed the couple was murdered. But Dominic Dunn, who was a longtime friend of Gig's, and we mentioned him in the first part, said it best, in my opinion. He said, quote, "Out of loyalty to him, people developed blind spots. Now, Gig was a man you could have more laughs with than anyone I ever knew. But there was a sadness behind his laughter, a sadness in his face. And I don't think I'm saying this in hindsight. He was so sensitive, such a truly complicated man. Happiness was probably always an impossible state for him to achieve. But because of their loyalty to him, people wanted to deny what had happened and insisted it couldn't be what it seemed. I think it was exactly what it seemed." Gig himself once said, "You can't tell about people from the outside because they spent a lifetime covering their fears." The whole thing is just really sad. I think with the explicit photos and all that, I think he was trying to probably like get something going because he had issues sexually. And so that was probably that. It sounds like he had stopped taking everything. And, you know, I'm not a doctor. I don't know what kind of withdrawal that is. But just thinking about being in that apartment and just even just reading about it, I feel trapped. Like, it feels like the walls are closing in. There's just like no escape.
Well, and everything's just kind of steadily still going downhill. And even getting off the substances, it's probably the realization of like, your career is gone. You're in these relationships that really don't have any meaning to either person.
And you're not sleeping now.
You're not sleeping. Sleep deprivation. When I say this, I don't mean it to sound callous, but like, I'm not surprised it got to this point.
Yeah, exactly. And some people that knew him said the same thing.
Yeah.
Elaine Stritch found out about the deaths while on that boat ride back to London. And I thought this was just interesting. Lieutenant Richard Gallagher, one of the detectives, said that a psychologist had once explained to him that for many who take their own lives in the way Gig had, by putting the gun in their mouth, that to them, and I don't know how, you know, how true this is, but that to them it represents their mother's nipple. And because man is nurtured as a baby sucking a nipple, they feel a need to, quote, suck the metal nipple, which is what like police call it, I guess, to end their life. I'd never heard that before. I just thought that was
interesting. That's weird. No, that is interesting. I've never thought of it like that.
I don't know that I even buy it, but
when you say that, my mind thinks, what? No.
Yeah, it is interesting.
I mean, but we have a subconscious that, or an unconscious that operates outside of things. So maybe, I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. Marty Baum did acquire Gig's Oscar, which he kept in his office. But in 1997, Jennifer, Gig's daughter, took him to court because she wanted it. She had no case, though, because it was in the will that it should go to Marty. But Marty told her when he died, it should go to her.
Jennifer.
He passed in 2009, and so then she did inherit it. And Gig Young does have a star on the Walk of Fame. He received it back in 1960. And the policy of the Hollywood Chamber of Commerce is that once a person's star has been added to the Walk, it stays. They do not remove it, even if that person has committed murder.
Damn.
And that's it.
Whoa.
So if you're watching the Oscars Sunday night or whenever they're airing for you, wherever you're listening to this, let's just hope that no one goes and does murder. Don't you do murder.
I love that you're like, so when you're watching the Oscars, just think, what could happen?
You never know with people.
You never know.
People be wildin'. Let us know your thoughts on Instagram, Facebook, or YouTube at
Horrorwood Podcast.
Or shoot us an email at
horrorwoodpodcast@gmail.com.
And you can also hop on over to Patreon if you're feeling so inclined. You got a little loose change in those pockets. And that can be done at
patreon.com/ Horrorwood Podcast. Give us $20.
Give me $20. It's only $2.
Actually, yeah, or two.
Or five. If you want some bonus episodes.
Bonus. Bow, bow, bow.